Hi, welcome to Holton Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Barbara Rossing is talking on bread making at Emmaus. Let's listen to Barbara.
Oh, good. Okay, great. It's the third verse. So we'll just sing hymn number 42 in your verse 3. What's it do?
Acapella or piano.
Oh, we can do acapella. Or do you want to play?
No, not necessarily. I played enough this week.
Okay, and you can harmonize whatever. Christ is the living bread, the source of grace our Lord. Our deepest hunger shall be fed, in Christ life is restored. Earth's hungry shall rejoice, for they shall all be filled. The story in Luke 24. And then tomorrow I want to look at the book of Acts and how food themes continued to be a struggle and a joy in the early church. A real mixed blessing and very difficult for the church, yet a source of great joy also. But today we'll look at how the resurrection appearance in Luke 24 is in many ways the culmination of all the meal scenes we've seen. So I'm going to look at some of the common vocabulary and common words that are found in them and common themes. And then, and all the connections this builds. And then also how this is a unique scene, so important in the Gospel of Luke, and also how it can inform our lives. And the principal theme in this story is that of recognition, how in the bread-breaking event, disciples' eyes, our eyes are open to recognize Jesus. How first we don't recognize him, it's playing with themes of blindness and sight, of not recognizing and then recognizing Jesus, and it's this bread-breaking experience that does it. Let's see, I wanted to pick up a couple loose ends. Okay, this is kind of a funny one, but this is for you gardeners here. Remember how I didn't even bring the book, that guy Robert Karras, a Roman Catholic biblical scholar, who's sort of, I'm using as a foil this week, how he thinks, he's got this thesis that in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is crucified because of the way he eats. And I do sort of agree with that. That's not the only reason, but I think it's really important. He goes on to say that the aroma of food issues forth from every chapter of the Gospel of Luke. And so I just wanted to show you where he finds the aroma of food in the crucifixion story. And you can see what you think on this, because it's hard. In some of the chapters, he has to really stretch it to find the aroma of food. But on the other hand, it's kind of neat. Okay, so for him in the crucifixion chapter, it's Luke 23, verse 43. And this is a nice verse, and it's unique to Luke. This is Jesus talking, they're all hanging on their crosses, the three of them, and he's talking to the thief who confesses him then as Christ and says to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." And Karras points to the way that there's a whole food tradition with paradise themes, that paradise is the place where the tree of life grows perpetual fruit, that there's abundant manna. There was a whole tradition of dreaming and thinking about paradise as a place where you get to eat a lot. So he points to this as the meal scene that occurs in Luke 23, in addition to the fact that Jesus is given vinegar to eat.
In the King James Version, doesn't it say your feast would be today in paradise?
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked at King James, but I was looking at the Greek because I thought maybe it does say today you will eat with me in paradise, and it doesn't. So.
The feast with me someplace.
Well, it's in, may feast in paradise. So it's when we sing, be present at our table, which is nice. We're taking off on this. I don't think so. I don't think there's even any manuscripts. I'll investigate that one and let you know tomorrow. That would be great, wouldn't it, if it does say that way. But then it wouldn't have been such a stretch, I don't
think. Sounds like we're doing a little proof texting.
Well, yeah, but we're looking for food. See, we need to stretch it. No, I don't see any. There's no eating in here. No, you will be. It's a be verb. It's not an eat verb. Unless you want to do, you know, to be is to eat, or something like that.
Mark, it's as you said here, there's a little footnote here in the RSV, Revelation 2:7. To him who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God.
Yes. Okay. I didn't do the book. I decided not to do the book of Revelation this week, but that's my field that I love to study. And yes, in the book of Revelation, there's eating and drinking themes all over the place. And definitely in Revelation, you are eating of the tree of life. It grows fruit 12 months of the year. Very careful to point that out. There's not a single month that there isn't any fruit. And there's manna. Yeah, there are a lot of promises about eating in the book of Revelation, if you want to look at that. Both at the beginning and then in the New Jerusalem vision, where they're all fulfilled in the drinking of the river of the water of life. It's really wonderful. What I did want to say, though, for you gardeners, is that the word paradise in Greek, is exactly the same as the word garden. So this could just as well be translated, today you will be with me in my garden. I mean, you cannot tell in Greek when it's paradise that's implied, you know, the afterlife, and when it's a garden. When people planted parks and gardens, those were called paradisos. So I just thought I'd give that as a sort of plug for gardening. Next time you're out in your garden weeding those vegetables, think of it as a paradise. Because it's the same as this meal thing. Every garden is a paradise, every paradise is a garden. It's the same word, identically. There's no difference in Greek, but of course we do think that this one is paradise here. It would make no sense for today you will be with me out in the garden. But anyway, you can be in paradise when you're in your garden. So just a little aside there. Okay, first a word about resurrection appearances in the gospel. The Easter appearances, all the gospels have the empty tomb story, fairly similar, although we'll look at Luke's and I'll show you a couple things. But beyond that, each of them has some appearance narratives of Jesus actually appearing with the disciples. And these are really different in all the Gospels. I don't know if you've ever looked at this book, Gospel Parallels. I did put this one and Manna and Mercy on the Book to Block table in the bookstore. This is for those of you who are pretty serious about wanting to do some Bible study. This is a great tool, because what it does is lay out the three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and shows you where they differ and where they're the same, what changes each makes. You know, this working with this idea that the Gospel of Mark is the oldest, and then Matthew and Luke are making changes off of that. Well, what happens with the Easter appearance stories, let's see, I'll hold it up so you can see, is that you no longer even have three columns, because they're all so different. You don't even bother to show which are making what changes. They're all different. Each Gospel writer has a unique version of these Easter appearances. And this is one of the most important places then that we can see what the central foci for this individual Gospel writer are. These communities remembered the events differently. And it makes sense that a resurrection is sort of the hardest thing to describe, an Easter appearance. I mean, it's beyond any of our words to describe how Jesus came to us, what his body looked like, what he was like as risen Lord. So the stories get very different here. And in some ways, Luke's are my favorite, although I like the John one with the 153 fish. I think it's great that they remembered the number and the Easter breakfast there. But Luke, this story of walking on the Emmaus Road and then going to sit at table with Jesus, I think is really a wonderful story. And none of the other Gospels have anything like this. The theme of recognition, though, is also found in John, that somehow Jesus in his risen body wasn't immediately recognizable to Mary Magdalene. So she thinks that he's the gardener in the Gospel of John, you know. Well, the same sort of thing happens with the disciples in this story, where they walk and talk with him on the road, but they don't seem to know who he is. Their eyes are kept somehow from recognizing him. So whether his risen body was so different, or whether God had deliberately blinded their eyes. We don't know. But it's this idea of recognizing and not recognizing, the movement from not seeing to seeing that happens in the Gospel of Luke, and it happens around food here. Just a couple other themes that we'll see in Luke's Easter appearances here that are also themes that he's been using throughout the Gospel. First of all, the centrality of Jerusalem. In two of the other Gospels, there are resurrection appearances up in Galilee, or down in Galilee. I keep saying up because it's north, but with the Bible, you should always go up to Jerusalem and then down to anywhere else. Down to Holden. Down to Holden Lake. Down to Lyme, you know. Down to Cloudy Pass, because it's not Jerusalem. So anyway, down to Galilee, but I'm going to say up because it's north. And that's how we say it. But anyway, in a couple of the other Gospels, he appears in Galilee. In Luke, it's very focused around Jerusalem. They're specifically told to stay in Jerusalem until they receive the power of the Spirit, which is what's going to happen in the book of Acts at Pentecost. And we'll look at that tomorrow, the Acts story. So staying in Jerusalem, and Emmaus is just a few miles outside of Jerusalem, a 7-mile walk, about as far as Holden Lake and back or whatever. I mean, it's not too far, but they're staying around Jerusalem. They're not going to Galilee. And the theme of necessity, we'll see that over and over, that it was necessary that Jesus should suffer and die. It wasn't a mistake. Luke is going to say that over and over, that everything followed in an orderly way. We shouldn't have been surprised by his suffering and crucifixion. It was all foretold in the scriptures. That's the final thing. The idea of the Old Testament having prophesied everything that happened to Jesus. So none of it should be unexpected. It was all planned and foretold. Even though we think that the Gospel of Luke was written by a Gentile Christian, not a Jewish Christian, although the community was probably mixed, Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, he's very grounded in the Old Testament. It was all foretold. I forgot to mention when we did the feeding of the 5,000 how grounded that narrative is in one of Elisha's miracles. Maybe if we have time later, we can look at that. So that he's situating Jesus in the tradition of the Old Testament prophets. It was all necessary. It had all been foretold, and other prophets had done many of these things. So we'll see those themes now in looking at the resurrection. Okay, to sort of build up to the actual meal, I thought we could look at a couple of the other resurrection scenes, too, that kind of precede it. And then we'll get to the big meal where Jesus breaks bread and reveals himself. And be thinking about ways that those kinds of revelations happen to us also in bread-breaking experiences. I think the board says bread-making at Emmaus, but it's not making bread, it's breaking bread at Emmaus. The schedule board got a little bit wrong there. So they didn't make bread, but they broke bread. Okay, let's start with the empty tomb story here, because I think it's wonderful the role the women play in this story and how this already shows some of Luke's themes. So this would be at the beginning of Luke 24. Scholars debate whether Luke is a particularly pro-women gospel or not. Many have said that it is, because there do seem to be a lot of times that stories about women are paired with those about men. My advisor, though, doesn't think it's very pro-women because of the way the Mary and Martha story is described. But anyway, this particular incident here, I think, is wonderful for women. In this gospel story, the women come up looking very good. And in fact, they are the proclaimers of the resurrection. So would somebody read to us Luke 24, 1 through 11?
But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, taking the spices that they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. The women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified and on the third day rise again." Then they remembered his words. And returning from the tomb, they told all this to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women with them who told this to the apostles. But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them.
somebody's translation of the early Bible study had utter nonsense, but yeah, they didn't believe. Notice though in this one, already that theme of, you know, well, why are you surprised? It was all prophesied, it was all foretold, this happened just like it was supposed to happen. You know, this idea that it's not chaos that has happened to them, because, you know, Jesus died, and you know how somebody's death just, it shatters your whole life, everything is broken, and it's that feeling of chaos, terrible chaos, that you can't even go through the routines you once did, and they're certainly in that kind of terrible shock and grief. And now the angels are saying, well, you know, you shouldn't be surprised, because remember how he told you in advance. Now remember, and the wonderful thing about this story is that they do remember, unlike so many of the other stories of, you know, disbelief, disobedience, where Peter is told, you will deny me, and he says, no, I won't, and then he does. In this case, in verse 6, the women are told, remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinners and be crucified and on the third day rise. And in verse 8, they do remember his words. Oh, yeah, he did tell us. Okay, they remember, and they go and proclaim to the 11. It's a wonderful story of faithfulness, of remembering, and then of proclamation. So already we see this theme of it was necessary and it was according to the scriptures. Okay, now the Emmaus story. Does anybody have any comments on this one, the empty tomb, before we go along?
Where in the Old Testament does it say that he would die on the cross?
No. No, it's the early Christian community. You can see this especially in the book of Acts, in some of the speeches of Acts. The struggle to interpret Jesus according to the Old Testament. It wasn't, they used texts like Isaiah 53 was a favorite one where it talks about must suffer. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. There are passages that say, cursed is anyone who hangs on a tree, and tree being cross. It's the Greek word xylon there. And Paul picks up on that in Galatians. But no, there's no specific foretelling of the Messiah as dying on a cross. They look a lot to the Psalms, because the Psalms, you know, have a lot of these Psalms of lament. Well, the crucifixion narrative in many ways follows Psalm 22, the my God, why have you forsaken me? They give me vinegar and gall to drink. And in some scholars think a lot of the details of the crucifixion, which would have been so hard to remember, were actually filled in according to the Psalms, knowing that Jesus was fulfilling these. But no, there's no actual prediction of a cross.
Well, except Jesus does say, and when I am lifted up, I will draw all men to me.
And that's
New Testament, though. But,
right. But it's picking up on, is it Deuteronomy? Oh, I should know this. No, it's a Numbers text. Numbers. He's picking up on a Numbers passage there of the serpent that Moses lifted up onto that stick, that very strange Bible story. Of Peter's here, he can explain that one to us. It's one of the oddest stories in the Bible of these, the people are being bitten by snakes, and so Moses takes the snake and puts it on a pole. And so the idea of lifting up, yeah, you can find that already. You can find all the themes in the Old Testament, but not the actual cross itself. Anybody else on the empty tomb? This story is found in all the Gospels, that women were the first witnesses to the empty tomb. They went with spices to anoint him and said they find the empty tomb and proclaim it. Interestingly, Paul does not mention the women among the witnesses of the resurrection, but they must have been. I mean, it's known so far and wide. Oh, I'll just tell you about this little handout. If anybody wants to see, I didn't know I was going to be teaching Bible today. I was going to teach up here some sessions on Gospels that didn't make it into the Bible, one of which is a very short little Gospel that was found at Nag Hammadi, you know, in, it was in 1945, maybe it was in the 50s, in Upper Egypt. All these texts that we didn't know, these Gnostic texts were found. The Gospel of Thomas is probably the most famous, but another short little one was called the Gospel of Mary. And this is only a story of a resurrection appearance of Jesus to Mary, and then disputes between Mary and the other disciples about whether she can actually preach or not. And the disciples say, you know, don't let this woman talk to us. But Jesus does reveal to Mary. Although being a Gnostic text, what he reveals to her is really weird. And I'm actually very glad that this gospel did not make it into the Bible. But anyway, if you want to take a look at another resurrection appearance, it's very, all the gospels have that Mary Magdalene and the other women were the first witnesses to the empty tomb here. Okay, now let's go to the Emmaus Road story. I really love this story. I think it's such a wonderful one. I'll tell you how I, when I'm sort of imagining about this story, is I don't think of it as the Emmaus Road. I think of it as me walking down the trail to Holden Lake or somewhere else, some road. Wherever you walk when you're struggling with issues or whatever, walking and talking, kind of pouring out your heart, all your doubts and struggles and how things haven't turned out the way you want and what that's like. Because that's what's going on here with these disciples on this road. Let's see, would somebody read, it's kind of long, but would somebody read, I don't know how to divide it up because it's one big long conversation. Well, somebody read until you get tired and then the next person will read. How's that? And we'll go 13 through 27 here.
That very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation which you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?"
Oh, good, you're tired. Next.
It's verse 19 for anyone who lost his mind.
And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since this happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning and did not find his body. And they came back saying they had even seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. But him they did not see. And he said to them, 'O foolish men and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself."
Thanks. I should just say, we are still using here at Holden the Revised Standard. We're hoping someday to replace them all with new Revised Standard, because where it says in verse 25, "O foolish men," for example, we don't know who these two guys were. One is named as Cleopas. The other is unnamed, could have been a woman. It doesn't say, "Oh, foolish men." It says, "Oh, foolish ones." So, you know, it probably was a man. We don't know. But the RSV tends to put in men where there aren't even men in the Greek. So just to note that. It's, oh, you fools, that kind of thing. All right, just an aside.
And RSV says, "Oh, how foolish you are and how slow of heart."
Yeah, and that's correct. It says, "Oh, agnoia, people." Oh, yeah. Oh, you've got NRSV. Okay, good. Okay, so this, let's see. Yeah, this story is without parallel in the other Gospels. They need to stay around Jerusalem in Luke because they've been commanded to wait here. And so they're just walking about 7 miles outside of town. And then it's this wonderful, you know, conversation where this guy joins the other two people who are walking and says, "You know, what are you talking about? And, you know, are you the only one? Haven't you been reading the papers, watching TV? You know, don't missed out on this whole thing." And then he starts teaching to them from the scriptures, because they say, you know, this is a terrible thing has happened. It's, you know, we had hoped he was the one to redeem Israel, but, and the implication is, but I guess he's not, because look what happened. He was crucified and died. And then, you know, while our women amaze us with this vision, but we don't know what to think. And then he opens to them the scriptures and talks with them and shows how it was necessary. Again, this theme, the Greek word is day here. It's necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into glory. And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he goes through the whole scriptures. Well, just what we were talking about here, how you can find in the Psalms and in the prophets that this indeed was foreshadowed in the Old Testament. It's all happened according to plan. Any comments on this one? Jonathan?
For me, this idea of it being necessary already distances the writer a little bit from or the experience we perhaps have to have with Jesus, or appreciation of who he is and what he did. And it's already playing a little bit of the commentator, the analyst, and that very quickly becomes a film in front of us, and Jesus struggles, Jesus' sufficiency as a model, as a guide, as a friend, who faces things we face and lives them out to unto death. Whereas here it's almost like, well, it was all predicted and he was going through the motions and it was necessary for me, a necessity to suffer. You know, well, suffering isn't a necessity when you're in the middle of it. It's a bad thing if you have to struggle with it. And I think that's probably the way it's best seen in Jesus' life and in our own lives. You know, not to already do a number on the suffering.
Yeah.
So I react a little bit to that kind of thinking, if you're saying that a thread through Luke. I'd rather have it straight up.
Uh-huh.
It could also be the temptation for the writers to try to make it sound as similar as possible.
Well, it's the terrible problem that the church faced. I mean, it's all sort of in retrospect. They want to show that it was necessary because, you know, if you read the Old Testament, it isn't obvious that it is necessary.
It's their agenda.
Yeah, it's definitely their agenda, writing back onto it to try to find that chaos hasn't disrupted everything. On the other hand, I see what you're saying, and I think that's really important. I don't know how others of you think of it. On the other hand, I've heard, the Moonies, for example, the Unification Church takes the stance that the whole crucifixion of Jesus was his backup plan. He came to earth to try to convert people and establish a kingdom, and then when that wasn't working, then he went with plan B, which was, you know, okay, you know, what's my fallback plan? Okay, get crucified, die, and save the world that way. And so I don't want to have that either. I mean, I think we need to struggle, as the early church did, with here's our central identifying event, the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. It doesn't seem to have been predicted in the Old Testament. At least, you know, Jewish people definitely say, reading the Old Testament, you don't see it leading to this. So how can it make sense? And I think it's that struggle to make sense of this event that happened to Jesus, and how could it have been part of God's plan when it doesn't show up more strongly earlier on? There isn't a prediction. No prophet says, there will come a man who will die on the cross and he will save the world. And so it's a struggle. But yeah, as soon as it becomes this kind of flat, oh yeah, you know, well, that happened because it was necessary. All predestination, we're just programmed robots walking around. That's not good either.
Well, it's a little bit exactly on those lines that I was trying to say. You know, how do you explain the power of Jesus' life and death? Do you do it this way by fitting it into the master plan we try to perceive? Or do you say he lost his life for us in order to gain, in order to show the way of salvation? You know, that way of dying and living, which is the dilemma we live with and struggle with so hard, and we analyze it to death. So, you know, which way of explanation do you choose? And I find this one to be a slightly lower road than the one which ponders what it meant for him to do what he did, and not at all plan B, plan A plus. It's also a point at which we part company with the Muslims. We can go a long way with Muslims on the basis of Jesus as a great prophet. But they don't believe he was crucified either. There was somebody else on the cross. Because anybody who was like that couldn't have been crucified in their minds. That would be a denigration of God. But why did God get crucified, you know? In the most immediate and personal and human terms, rather than in the context of interpreting scriptures and what it all predicted and just argued.
No, it's true. And Luke thinks the way to make it most meaningful is to make it necessary. And maybe we can say, other Gospels do it different ways. I mean, John, well, Luke also knows how to use irony really strongly. John does too, the ironic where he'll put into the mouth of, the chief priest, well, it's better that one man should die than that we all should, the Romans should crack down on all of us. And then, it's that ironic thing that we know when he says it's better that one man should die for the people, that that is truly what we believe Jesus did in a completely different way from what he believes. I mean, so but yeah, it's true. Luke is heavy on the let's make it meaningful by saying it was necessary. And maybe for us that isn't the most meaningful way. And certainly we want to say that he was killed by the Romans. It wasn't, well, that it was, he was executed like a criminal because he was a threat, and that in that sense of the outrage of that too.
But then I think it is a little more palatable to when we read Luke, and particularly passages like this, when we take a look at the authorship, Luke, the physician, analytical mind, and from that standpoint, I think it does make sense where he's coming from.
Doctors want to get it all in order?
Yeah, it's not good.
Okay. Yeah, and you see it especially in the speeches of Acts, too, that it's every speech, Paul, Peter, all of them, Stephen, they all need to go through the whole Old Testament sort of briefly. You know, that's why when those texts are read in our Easter season, they get kind of boring because there are these long speeches showing how it was all necessary. It was necessary. It was all according to plan and stuff. And maybe that isn't for us the most meaningful.
Just comment, but the pattern, the Old Testament and the pattern of the prophets coming, and consistently the prophets seem to be discredited, or they tried to kill them, or they'd kill them. And look at Elijah, the greatest prophet, and how much he was chased, and it was a price on his head, and all the suffering he went through. And you look at that pattern, and Christ fits that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've often thought, in what we saw and what happened to the prophets, we could then see God sending his son as a final solution to this problem. And you see the same pattern occur. The Jews rejected him and would not listen to what he said. But John lost his head and all through all those prophets.
So it's not so much the idea of everything being predicted as it should be predictable that when a prophet challenges the powers that be, this is how he'll end up. Because it's the pattern of the rejected prophet. Jeremiah the same way too. He was, the official prophets hated Jeremiah's words, and he got thrown in that pit too. I mean, and his where he pours out his soul in lament about, why is this happening? But yeah, that pattern, that of the rejected prophet, that's helpful. Thanks. Okay, well, let's move on to the meal here. This is this wonderful bread-breaking scene. And what I want to look, we'll read it first and then look at ways that it connects with some of the other meals we've seen. I didn't write up the meals with Pharisees and the meals with tax collectors here, except for the time about Zacchaeus. But let's look at this bread-breaking scene and see where we've seen some of this before and what it can say. But thanks, Jonathan, for bringing up that comment about the it is necessary question here. Okay, who wants to read 28 through 35?
So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He appeared to be going further, but they restrained him, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were open, and they recognized him. And he vanished out of their sight. They said to each other, "Do not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. And they found the 11 gathered together and those who were with them, who said, "The Lord has risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had known to them, was known to them in the breaking of the bread.
So it's the same kind of after the fact idea that now, after this moment that happens with recognition, they say, "Did not our hearts burn within us on the road?" And I guess that's why I love this story so much, is, you know, thinking about it doesn't name the road that they were on. When I was in seminary, one of my friends had a banner on her wall that said, "Did not our hearts burn within us as he walked with us on the Dixon Road?" And that was the name of the street she lived on. Somebody had made this banner for her. So I like to think of it, and I invite you to think of it too, is, "Did not our hearts burn within us as he walked with us on the Holden Lake path, or as he walked with us on Lincoln Lane," or whatever the name of your street is, wherever you go to walk and try to sort things out and stuff like that. And it's after the fact of this incredible bread-breaking event here that somehow their eyes were kept from recognizing him in verse 16, but now with the bread-breaking, they do recognize him. And take a look at some of the themes of this text that recall stuff we've seen before, especially the feeding of the 5,000. We went kind of quickly over that scene, was it yesterday? No, Wednesday. But a lot of the themes are similar, only at the time of the feeding of the 5,000, of course, they didn't realize it. It was just a scene of hungry people, and the question was, would they send them away or would they figure out a way to feed them? But there wasn't any teaching that happened in that meal as far as, you know, people didn't come to a profounder recognition of Jesus as the Christ or anything like that. It was Jesus feeding hungry people. He wanted them to have enough to eat. He didn't want to send them away hungry, and so he fed them. But now, looking backwards from Luke 24, we can see a lot of these same kind of Eucharistic overtones and very powerful symbolic themes that were going on in that text. The time of day is the same in Luke 24 and chapter 9. I finally went now and translated the Greek. And it's really interesting. What it says is the day is reclining, literally in Greek. Toward evening, the day is lying down, kata klino. Klino is a bed. And so it's like the day is going to lie down. And both of them have exactly the same words on that. It's getting towards evening in the feeding of the 5,000 in Luke 9. And it's getting towards evening now in Luke 24. One little difference here, though, is that it's not clear in this scene who's the guest and who's the host, right? We sorted out the meals in Luke. Jesus is a guest at the house of the Pharisees. He's a guest of Levi and Zacchaeus. He's a guest here also, but he quickly assumes the role of host, it seems, and does the host acts of bread breaking. Okay, they constrain him, saying he pretends he's going on or seems like he's going to go on, and they say, "Stay with us." This is the stay, meno is the Greek word. It's the same word that was used in the Zacchaeus story, where Jesus says to Zacchaeus, "I must stay at your house today." Remember, we talked about whether to read that as an eating verb or not, whether that was in fact a meal scene. But this idea of stay with us, so he went in to stay with them here, and that's that same word that was used in that Zacchaeus scene. So we're getting recollections of all these other scenes that have already reeled by on the screen here in Luke, and now we're seeing how all of those had these same overtones in them. Okay, the English here says when he was at table with them, but this isn't table, it's reclining. Just like the day is reclining, now they recline, just as they did the feeding of 5,000. It's like a lying down or a leaning verb. They would lie on their couches and lean on their elbows and eat with their other hand. So while he was reclining with them, and here are the verbs that are exactly the same as the ones that we're using in the feeding of the 5,000. Now, in Luke 24, there's no fish, right? It's just bread. In the Eucharist, the Last Supper of Luke 22, there was wine and bread, and the wine was first, so it was cup, bread, cup. In the feeding of the 5,000, it's bread and fish. Now, in this one, it's just bread. But the verbs are the same. Taking bread. Yeah, why Jesus was, he just assumes the role of host here, but anyway, he needs to do that. Taking bread, we don't have look up here. He blessed it. Eulogeo is the word for blessing here, so it's unlike the Eucharist scene where the word is Eucharist, but it's the same idea of giving thanks. He broke it, and he gave it to them. In this case, in the feeding of the 5,000, he gave it to the disciples to give to the crowd. In this one, he gives it to them, but it's those very same words. And somehow, in that action, And we spent some time in the first session here talking about what it was about that led to recognition. We, of course, see it in exactly the same verbs. These are the ones that are used also in the words of institution. He took bread, gave thanks, broke it. But whether it was what do you think led to the recognition? Was it some technique Jesus had of bread breaking? Was it the fact that this was almost his moniker, his tag act, sort of, that was so familiar that the minute he breaks bread, they go, oh yeah, bread breaking. We've seen somebody do that before. This is Jesus, or how it was. But it's in that bread breaking that their eyes are open to recognize him. Uh-huh.
Way back in history when I was in college, I remember a humanities course. We read a book called Bread and Wine.
Oh, Ignazio Saloni, right?
Okay, I can't remember much about the book, mm-hmm. other than it emphasized that this bread and wine ritual was not at all unique to the New Testament and to Jesus, but that was a cultural thing, and that was a way of having community. And here we make it sound as if it's terribly unique, whereas from what I remember of that book, it was the language that was used, or it was symbolic for lots
right.
of people from lots of cultures.
No, absolutely. I don't mean to imply that it's unique. It's unique to Luke, but it's certainly the most ordinary of actions, right? I mean, bread is the staff of life. It's an everyday event that we do as bread breaking. It's the most common act. And I think that's what's so wonderful about this, is it's not some exotic ritual that you need to do that's, you know, so unusual. It's bread breaking. It's food sharing. It's the thing that we do all the time. Thanks for that reminder. Uh-huh.
Could it be sort of like deja vu when he broke it, however he did, it went through their mind how they had been with Jesus and he broke it in the same way at that point. So I know things that have happened now, something very simple will trigger a memory from way back of a similar kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting for me that in all the discourse on the trail, the same revelation didn't come to them.
I know.
But it came in a nonverbal moment of intimacy, of togetherness, of simplicity, as you say, you know, without spoken. You know, maybe Verlon could help us, but these were men, their brains didn't get it. they had the body had to say it.
Yeah, why are men the way they
Well, and like the service last night about, you know, we don't know Jesus until we commit to knowing Jesus. I mean, we can't just intellectualize about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the road they were trying to intellectualize about what's going on, but it is in the
being
present with each other.
That's why theologians have so much trouble getting into heaven.
Present company accepted, actually.
But what are some of the ideas about why there is this delay? What was so important about their not recognizing him as they were walking along?
Well, we don't. I mean, here we are, and we have to leave our ordinary life, where Christ is present as much as he is up here, to come away. I mean, you know, Christ is present in as much in our daily lives, wherever we are, but here we come away to hold him, to find him. I mean, is this making sense to anybody else? Mm-hmm. And so I think this is very common in our lives. You know, that we sit around, we intellectualize, or we go to worship, but we don't get it. You know, I mean, this is true of Lutherans. How many of us went through a phase where we were raised Lutheran, but we didn't get it? And then something had to happen, you know, Theo 101 in college, or, you know, meeting up with some other religion, where we have to grapple with it a little bit. We don't get it until we have some kind of special encounter. And I think this is their special encounter.
It's always comforting to me to realize how many times the disciples didn't get it. Right there in his presence, and like you said,
But it is necessary that intellectualization has to have been experienced. The walk on the road, the experience in the classroom, the 101, or whatever, and then in the very simple breaking of bread, something snapped, and you know, that's the guy.
Something's. And then they can go back and say, oh yeah, walking on the road, weren't our hearts burning then? Well, you don't hear them earlier say, my heart is burning. You know, they're just talking with this guy saying, you know, God, where have you been? How did you not know about this? Doesn't sound like people whose hearts were burning, but after the fact, yeah, the intellectualizing all makes sense. Well, I think the reason it's like this is the weight of the narrative needs to fall on this bread-breaking scene as the eye-opening experience somehow. And that even though we are talking about the sort of it is necessary that he should suffer and die, no amount of sort of proof texting of exposition on scriptures is going to make God's word the living bread for you unless that kind of recognition happens. I mean, you can proof text with, you know, well, this Bible passage proves this and this one proves that, but it's not the same as this experience that happens to them. And in Luke's community, it's a bread-breaking kind of experience. He wants the Eucharist to be the central event in the week in people's lives that is the eye-opener, that the moment where we see Jesus is in the bread. And so that's why it's this meal experience in this case. It's not, first of all, the scriptures, but then they can go back and say after the fact, yeah, our hearts were burning. Just like the fire of Pentecost is going to come upon them, and that sort of burning, the feeling of, yeah, it all makes sense now.
And then he vanishes.
Yeah, he always vanishes. That's a real typical Easter thing. Yeah. A couple of hands back here.
Some of you may not agree with me at all, probably many of you don't, but I feel that there's a lot of meaning in dreams. And this is like a dream episode. And though there are emphasis on road to Emmaus, etc., but still it seems like a dream episode that's easy to comprehend, where you're going along with someone and you know he's a familiar person, but you don't know who that is, and then something is done, and then you say, that's who it was. And you kind of wake up and you have this marvelous experience of actually having dreamt of living with this person or being with this person, and it is so very real and even more meaningful than actually having been with a friend, that there is something so very strong about this intimate feeling and experience that we can have in a dream.
Thanks.
We used to kid at our house. Kids come home with their report cards, and as they hand it to them, they'd say, they all say the same thing, slow but working to capacity. I think that, I'm very impressed. I one time went through the New Testament, the common, I don't know what the count was now, but I was fascinated by the number of times it said, yay, Lord. It opened up somebody saying, yay, Lord, after being Lord. But I heard you say something this morning, Mark, that really tells me. For the number of times that we say, yay, Lord, in other words, getting it the first time, it's pretty rare. I heard you say, oh, yeah. And it seems to me that that's what we as Christians, most of us here do. Occasionally we say, oh yeah, slow but looking to capacity.
and it's glimpses, and we need to help each other. Yeah, great, thanks. A couple thoughts?
I was thinking that, I'm sure there's going to be times in Simon's life again where he's going to not see Jesus again. Yeah. And I think that's true for all of us. I mean, I don't think that he was all of a sudden fulfilled, but I think I always think of the time that somebody asked C.S. Lewis, if you have to be educated to be a Christian, and he said, no, being a Christian is an education. And I think that it's a process of always becoming. You know, you're never quite naked. You're never really fulfilled. And you have to come out, you have to come to hold it once in a while. You have to do things in your life to kind of, it's a process, and you never quite make it. And I think even though they saw him, they still didn't make it. And it's still not. There's still going to be times in our lives again where we're going to be back to where they were on the road.
Well, and we certainly don't want to just depend or only live for these recognition moments, as if, you know, if if I go to communion on Sunday or go up to the dining hall and I take communion and it doesn't seem to be one of those, you know, aha moments of recognition that it didn't happen. We don't want to have our experience be the bottom line that sort of decides whether communion takes or not. Because there will be those times that we go to communion and it doesn't feel like it takes, you know. And that doesn't mean that it didn't. That just means that, you know, this time we can rely more on scripture and on the promises and trusting those memories of those other experiences and trusting the communion that we find when they're, yeah, I'm glad you said that, because we don't want to just live for this recognition feeling and then think that everything else is invalid, because it's going to happen again that they're not going to feel like they see him. It happens to all of us. Uh-huh, up in the balcony.
Well, I think so much of God is mystery, and I think, you know, we can search for him with our mind, we can be in the places where he is, we can be serving or receiving, but it's God who comes to us, it's Jesus who comes to us, and we're not in control of that. It's just that we need to be where we need to be at the right time, and so often he comes to us in the ordinary, and it's kind of we need to be aware of how he comes so that we don't miss him in those ordinary times, because God is so much mystery that we don't know how he's going to come.
Yeah, and it's wonderful that it's always in surprising ways. I think that's my favorite single thing about Holden is the surprises, that you don't, it's the unexpected, and yet so often they turn out more wonderful than you could have wanted. But yeah, we can be sure of finding God in the communion, in the sacraments, but beyond that, it could be a surprise. It's a mysterious way. It just sort of happens, and just being open to that. There's a print that I love by Fritz Eichenberg, who used to do lithographs for the Catholic worker movement, called Christ in the Bread Line, where it's the guys lined up at the homeless shelter to come and get their meal, and one of those people in line is Christ. You can see him because he has a halo on, but he's dressed just like the other people in line. I mean, it's the anonymous grace and the anonymous nature of sort of the Christ in our midst that you don't know. It's sort of like, has any of you seen that Federal Express ad on TV about the golden package, I think it is, or something? You don't know which package it is the golden package, so all of them need to be treated with that sense of wonder. And all the moments, I mean, it's okay, it's very commercial and stuff, but they're trying to show how well they treat every package. But that sense of you don't know which meal it is, which table has Jesus at but the dining hall or whatever, and who's going to be Christ for you? It's all a surprise, because God does come in very wondrous and unexpected, mysterious ways. As you see. Just wanted to share one story that I learned about bread. When I lived in France, my junior year of college, my family always bought, you know, beautiful, wonderful loaves of unsliced bread. And the father of my French family, every time before he would slice into a new loaf of bread, would make the sign of the cross on the bottom of the loaf. I try to do that now, because I asked him, you know, Gabriel, why are you making the sign of the cross on the loaf of bread? It wasn't a particularly religious family. They did go to church, but not all the time and stuff. And he said, because of this story, and he told about bread breaking, that Christ comes to us in our bread breaking. Bread is the most sacred thing that we have. And I make the sign of the cross on it to mark it as that for us. So it's the idea of the most ordinary thing. I mean, we ate a lot of bread in France. Every meal you eat bread as the staple. And yet that every loaf of bread is sacred somehow too, and our bread breaking together is the way that we find God in our midst.
I think the other thing that's neat about this is kind of a sense of our own limits of understanding, that what there is in God and Christ showing us God is so much beyond what our capacity is to really understand. We only get glimpses of it. And I think this is a nice word for kind of reminding us of that. And the way a human brain works is so interesting, because you think of denial that happens when you're in grief, and you think of times when you haven't been able to recognize something because you just weren't ready for it. So we experience that all the time. But when I think, for me, in the last couple of years, one of the most important insights has been that my view of what there is so small compared to what there is. And this story sort of says that in a very beautiful way.
Yeah, it's a nice story because it has both non-recognition and recognition, and you can learn in both stages, and the one you can, yeah.
And our experience is really minimalized as we juxtapose it with the truth that's out there of God and God's love for us, and what we're talking about with the scriptures, as the disciples were speaking about that, and Jesus interpreting that, and the truth has always got to be greater than one's own individual experience. As you were saying, it's a given experience at the communion table might not really be a high that we might want it to be, but that really is okay. It doesn't matter that much. Let's not so depend upon how we feel all the time. Many denominations that go into that real heavily. And I was thinking of the hymn that we sang last night, the fourth verse of Dear Old Einfested Word, that word above all earthly powers forever is abiding. And down a bit, let goods and kindred go. And I put in also with that our own experience that we think is so almighty important all the time. This mortal life also abiding, God's reign endures forever.
Well, tomorrow we will talk about the food experiences of the early church and what a struggle these were for them. It wasn't just all joy. It was very, very difficult to break down the barriers to food sharing between Jewish and Gentile Christians, and they had a lot to work out. Also, how much to do in common. The early stories of Acts about holding possessions in common and eating meals together, and then that seems to have sort of dissipated, and, you know, did they become jaded about community life or what's going on there? But I just wanted to leave you with, we didn't get back to that question we had on Wednesday of how to make our communion services those kinds of moments. But I think the fundamental question with these scenes, in fact all the verbs are the same between a feeding story and a resurrection story and a Eucharist story, is very similar also, how we, when we leave Holden, can make our meals more Eucharistic, how we can have our feeding, you know, because we do need to feed ourselves and one another, how we can see God's grace more in those, and how powerful those can be, so that we, looking back, after having been to communion, we can look back on feeding events, on meals, and see that, oh yeah, Jesus was there blessing and with us. And then the flip side of it, how we can make our worship services, our Eucharist, our sometimes very dead communion services, as it seemed that some of you were saying on Wednesday, how we can make those more like meals, and build those ties between the feeding that happens to us in the one setting and the other, and thereby come to recognize Jesus in all those bread-breaking experiences. It's the same bread, it's the same actions of taking bread, giving thanks, and breaking it that happens in all those settings. And I think the power is in the connection, because that's the recognition. Okay, we don't want to miss another food function at Holden Village, so.
Hey, I've got one.
You don't want to take them back.
No, I don't want to take these on the airplane. After that. It's really weird, though. I mean, it's definitely a non-experience. I have to bring all my other handouts down to try to figure out a way to get those back done. For most sessions, I was going to be doing here nonstop. Do you have more of this? Because I don't know. Well, it's odd. Anybody else?
Thank you, Mary.
Okay, great.
Barbara, what do you think of the Gospel of Thomas? Is that something
that you... Oh, I've got copies of that too. I can bring them. Well, I think that it's important historically because it does have old sayings, and it's important for showing what Q might have looked like of just a sayings gospel and no narrative. But I certainly don't think it should be in the Bible. I don't use it. I use it as a historian, but not... it's interesting. I guess I would say that. It's very interesting, and it's old. But there are a lot of other old gospels, too. I think that the issue of what makes it in the Bible and what doesn't isn't on the basis of age. It's on the basis of how edifying it is and how truthful it is. And I wouldn't put the Gospel of Thomas in that category. But I think it's really exciting to whenever an old text gets dug up like that, because it can help us so much in understanding what...
Then it's gone again.
Well, I've done a lot of readings
Oh, okay, great.
Happy.